Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant David Jankowski, and along with Captain Paul LeBlanc and Major Jeffrey Liebenbeut, I represent the appellant in this case, Corporal Salyer. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I request 2 minutes of my time to reserve for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Neither the government nor the defense has the authority to remove or unseat a properly certified and detailed military judge. But that's what the government did here after it had enough of Judge Morey. In the face of a valid mistrial warrant, and after losing 4 critical rulings, the government's orchestrated, unlawful actions unseated a properly certified and detailed military judge. Now, these issues, Your Honors, have broad implications, but the decisional issue before this court today is quite narrow. Did Corporal Salyer receive a trial free from the taint of UCI? Because the answer to that question is no, and because the government cannot carry its high burden today, this court should dismiss Corporal Salyer's case with prejudice.
Now, what actually is the issue before us? The granted issue and the issue you assign does seem to narrow it down as to whether or not the case should be dismissed with prejudice in its current structure, and yet you argue all of the UCI arguments that were raised below, and the government has taken issue with that and said that there really is only one issue before this court, and that's whether or not the remedy was proper. What's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, appellant is happy to talk about the remedy, but at each stage of this litigation, appellant has challenged the rulings of the courts below. And under United States v. Doss, the question asked is whether the granted issue encompasses the issues preserved by appellant sufficient for this court to review them. Here, law of the case doctrine should not stop appellant from raising arguments that were raised at each stage of the litigation. Specifically, defense counsel at court-martial actually addressed the orchestrated actions of the government here via the phone call, the voir dire, the service record, and before the NMCCA, the lower court, Your Honors, appellant raised these issues again. These issues are.
Is it your position that if there is UCI involving a military judge and the military judge recuses himself for what you say are improper reasons, that therefore there must be dismissal with prejudice, full stop, that the ordinary inquiry is whether or not they could overcome the prejudice or whether there was remedial measures that could be taken, that those rules don't apply?
No, Your Honor. Certainly this court could take that approach, but appellant does not advance that argument today. Appellant simply invokes Lewis because the facts of this case are remarkably similar to Lewis. And in that case, this court fashioned the drastic remedy of dismissal with prejudice.
Okay, well, you don't disagree, or maybe you do. Do you or do you not agree that in this case that the second judge took remedial measures in response to the recusal of the first judge?
Appellant does not disagree with that, Your Honor, and the same thing happened in United States v. Lewis, where the new military judge also took remedial measures. There, he banned the SJA from both the courtroom and further participation in the case. He installed a new convening authority for post-trial review.
You're arguing that the measures were not adequate, or that there's per se, in a case like this, dismissal is the only remedy?
Your Honors, we're arguing that the remedies were insufficient. And specifically, even if this court were to find the remedies sufficient, which they are not, the record reveals that they were not fully implemented. Now, of course, because
okay,
of this
can I ask you one more question before you indicate why they were not fully implemented and what
yes,
effect
sir.
That had? The Biagi test, or however you pronounce that, the third element is whether or not the government, if you get to the third element, is whether or not the government has demonstrated that the UCI did not affect the outcome of the proceedings, or affect the proceedings. In Lewis, we also raised the issue of the appearance of command influence, whether it has been ameliorated and made harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and the government must convince us that the disinterested public would now believe the accused received a fair trial. Is this a tautology, or are these two different standards? The tautology would be where the government demonstrates that UCI did not affect the proceedings, the public QED would determine that the whole thing was wonderful, or whatever the standard is. Or are they two separate standards? One, raising the possibility that you could have a fair proceeding, but nonetheless, the public, in light of the events that occurred, would not believe that the system was a fair one, et cetera, blah, blah, blah.
Appellant would suggest it's the latter, sir. In this case, even if the court were to find that the remedies were sufficiently remedial and curative, the public still would have a problem knowing the fact that after receiving a conditional mistrial for the prosecutor commenting on evidence that was specifically excluded by the military judge during opening statement, and after four critical rulings that put the government in a proof problem, essentially, the government then pulled the military judge's service record without his permission, called his boss mid-trial addressing a specific ruling, and then later confronted him with the service record in open court, not once articulating a reason for bias, instead effectively using a peremptory challenge against the military judge, which the discussion section under Rule for Courts Martial 902 says is not available to unqualify or disqualify a military judge. Knowing all that happened, a reasonable member of the public would see that after the government bounced this judge, they then proceeded to move to reconsider rulings that the government had lost. So that shows that the government here, Your Honors, was concerned.
So which rulings the first judge made were favorable to the defense or favorable to the defense? The second judge change?
Your Honor, specifically that the second judge changed would be the confidentiality finding, which is a prerequisite under Military Rule of Evidence 504. Now, that became relevant because on November 7th, the government sought to amend the specifications at issue. It sought to strike the Title 18 language, which it did, and it sought to strike the laptop language because the defense's whole theory of the case, Your Honors, was that the government cannot produce a laptop, therefore the members cannot convict. So in order to get around that problem, because the laptop language remained in the spec, what the government did was try to call Corporal Salyer's wife. Corporal Salyer's wife could testify to this conversation she had with appellant while they were both deployed to Iraq, and she could say that this laptop went missing. Now, defense sought to block that, and the military judge, the first military judge, Judge Morey, found, he said, hang on one second. I am going to find that there was a confidential communication here. The issue is going to be waiver. Now, what's interesting is that in one of his remedial measures, Judge Richardson implemented what he called a refusal to reconsider defense-friendly rulings. Yet, he further said to the government that waiver is going to be a high burden for you to overcome. But he reversed the finding just two pages after he came on the record in this case of Judge Morey, and he found that there was no confidential communication. So he essentially obviated the government's burden of proof to show waiver on that case. And in that respect, the government was then able to introduce Corporal Salyer's wife to testify to the missing laptop, explaining away essentially the defense's central theory of the case.
Doesn't that come in anyway through his statement?
Well, no, Your Honor, and on that point, it's relevant to look at the defense's motion to exclude what they viewed as an uncorroborated statement under Military Rule of Evidence 304G. So this was the other saving grace from Ms. Salyer's testimony. It was able to corroborate, in the government's view, the admission from appellant to the FBI agent below.
Well, in what respect was the second judge's ruling with respect to an issue that had not been fully resolved by the first judge? In what respect was he incorrect?
Well, Your Honor, the issue wasn't fully resolved, but the first primary step to get to that issue was the finding of confidentiality.
Right, Juan, I'm asking you, with respect to that issue, how was the second judge wrong?
Well, the second judge was wrong, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, Corporal Salyer's wife testified at an Article 39A, during which time she essentially stated that, yes, she thought this conversation was secret. She thought it was between my husband and me. Now, the government had argued that because they were contemplating divorce at that point in time, that somehow militated in favor of a finding of privilege here. Moreover, the government argued because they were deployed into separate places, that also militated against a finding of privilege. Judge Morey rejected those arguments, Your Honor. And I believe it's at Joint Appendix 135, essentially, where he states that, you know, if a couple is contemplating divorce, all the more reason why we should want to protect their conversations and keep them privileged. So despite Corporal Salyer's wife saying that she believed this conversation was just between herself and an appellant, he found that it was, in fact, not a confidential communication. He further found that the two factors that Judge Morey relied upon in finding that it was a confidential communication actually militated against finding that it was a confidential communication. And he stated that because they were contemplating divorce, because they were separated and communicating between an internet chat function, that this militated in favor of finding no confidentiality.
Other than the ruling that you just talked about, what else, in what other respect did the second judge fail to uphold a ruling that the first judge had made that was favorable to the defense?
Well, Your Honor, essentially, Judge Morey gave a conditional mistrial ruling. After excluding Prosecution Exhibit 5 for identification, the government nevertheless commented on that exhibit during opening statement. Now, Judge Morey could have been within his rights to grant a mistrial right there, but he gave the government actually the benefit of the doubt and said, you know, where are you going to get this in? If you're not going to get it in, it's going to be a mistrial. That was never resolved, and in fact, Prosecution Exhibit 5 for identification was never admitted into evidence. There was one other point later in this court-martial where Judge Morey, and this did not make it into the joint appendix, Your Honors, but where Judge Morey did counsel the government once again on commenting on the subpoena, which was not admitted into evidence. And this is at record at 344-46. And I would invite your court's attention to those portions of the record there. And then third, with respect to prejudice, Your Honors, Colonel Morey left open the issue regarding the maximum confinement. Because he had taken a military-centric approach, because the government had taken a military-centric approach to this possession of child pornography charge, he had found that the age of a minor was going to be under 16 for purposes of child pornography. Now, the government argues that this ruling is perplexing, and that, and when Judge...
Was age, in fact, an issue with these pictures or not? If you look at the pictures, are they pictures of what one might think are teenagers, or are they pictures of what one might think are toddlers?
The answer is both, Chief Judge Baker. The government's own expert was going to testify to the fact that the ages would have varied from 5 to 17. And after a review of the evidence myself, I...
And how many pictures would the government have needed to prove distribution or possession?
Your Honor, I do not have the answer to that question. But it certainly was an issue that was put into play by the government when they, on November 7th, sought to strike the Title 18 language. Now, the government suggests that that issue and that ruling, the fact that the military judge somehow sua sponte raised this age issue, somehow shows bias. You can infer that from their brief. But it doesn't. What it does show, Your Honors, is that Judge Morey knew the law. Barely a year before he made that ruling, in United States v. NARAD, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals signaled that this could be an issue, that there's a logical...
Counsel, in terms of the maximum punishment, I mean, there's no question that these were real people, right?
There's no question, Your Honor.
Okay, I mean, we've settled that in United States v. Leonard. I mean, the maximum sentence that can be used is the maximum sentence for the analogous federal statute.
Well, Your Honor,
whether it's charged under Clause 3 or charged under Clause 1 or Clause 2, it's 10 years.
Well, under United States v. Leonard, this court did say that the military judge had discretion to look to the federal statute when that federal statute essentially mirrored the elements here. And it may very well have mirrored what elements were in this straight Clause 2 offense. But what's relevant, Your Honor, is that not all the definitions matched. And contrary to Judge Richardson's finding in the record, the age of a minor was different here. And that was consistent with Judge Morey's military-centric approach now to the government's theory of the case.
What is the ordinary method to evaluate whether a military judge's actual or implied bias in a case?
Well, the ordinary method would be to accept the military judge's invitation for voir dire. And we know that happened at least on two occasions. Judge Maury reached out to
us. Is there anything that reflects in the record or that we can take judicial notice of as to whether looking at a personnel file, is an ordinary method or an authorized method to test the actual or implied bias of a military judge?
There's nothing in the record that this court could take judicial notice of, Your Honor.
Does the Marine Corps have a rule or regulation pertaining to access to personnel records?
Well, they did at one point, Your Honor, but that rule was superseded. There is still a Department of Defense instruction, which would, of course, govern the Marine Corps, which implements the Privacy Act. And Section 552A states that generally privacy-protected information cannot be exchanged or disclosed between agencies or to other individuals except with written permission by the person to whom the record pertains. And here we do know in the record that Judge Morey never acceded to the government's accessing of this record.
Are there any other exceptions, or is that the sole exception, the written approval of the person in question?
There is an exception, Your Honor, that the person had a need to know. But if the government has a need to know, then so does the defense. And under Article 46 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, it states that both parties shall have equal opportunity to evidence here. Now, the government here never once disclosed this service record to my client. They didn't include my client or the defense counsel at trial on the phone call to the military judge. So the government cannot now reasonably argue that everything that was done here was above board. Indeed, the first words out of the OIC's mouth when he testified regarding the phone call to Captain Berger, the circuit military judge, he stated that he was, quote, unsure why his subordinate would have made such a ruling regarding the age issue. And he further stated, and he said, I believe these were my exact words, that I just want to let you know what's going on in a courtroom in your circuit.
I mean, now you're just rehashing what happened, and I don't think that's what we're focusing on now, right? I mean, no one disputes what happened.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Judge Baker's question went to the question of whether or not it's authorized or ordinary or somehow unlawful or and whatever the opposite of ordinary is, unusual, to access personnel files. So, for example, if trial counsel has a list of prospective members, if you have them, and you go down to Avon and say, I'd like to look at these service records, are you saying that the answer would be no?
Yes, Your Honor. The general rule should be no. And in fact,
that was what it should be. I'm asking you what actually happened.
Well, in this case, certainly there was testimony that this was an unusual case, that the pulling of the service record was something that was unusual. But if this court affirms the lower court, it's essentially sending a signal, albeit an unfortunate one, that perhaps in a drug case, if the military judge came in to the service on a drug waiver, would that now be discoverable? Should trial counsel move to obtain the records of seated military judges? Of course, the answer to these questions should be no. And Judge Morey has a duty to offer reasonable grounds for disqualification, and he did not do so here.
I mean, really, the question, counsel, I think that we have before us is whether or not whether everything that happened was ameliorated or not.
Right? I agree, Your Honor.
And it seems to me that your position is it can't be ameliorated because under United States versus Lewis, it needs to be dismissed with prejudice and there's nothing that could have been done.
Well, Your Honors, under United States v. Lewis, this court did evaluate whether or not the remedial measures were sufficient. So within that framework, appellant still argues that, one, the remedial measures were insufficient because just like this court's concern in Lewis, the trial counsel who conducted this one question voir dire on the first day and then came back and raised an issue of disqualification on the second day was the tool through which the UCI was implemented. And yet this trial counsel remained on the case just like the trial counsel remained on the case in Lewis, which again was one of this court's concerns in that case. But moving to United States v. Douglas, even if this court were to find that these issues were sufficiently remedial, the record fails to show that they were fully implemented. Indeed, this is almost a Douglas plus situation, Judge Ryan, because in this case, the record affirmatively shows that Judge Richardson reversed a prerequisite finding by Judge Morey under Military Rule of Evidence 504. So in light of that evidence, the government cannot carry its high burden today and show that this court-martial was purged, that the taint of UCI was purged from this court-martial.
You are, the appellant's position is not that this is so egregious that it's structural. The appellant's position is that it falls under the normal criteria for UCI.
Your Honor, appellant...
That's what you seem to have argued.
Yes, Your Honor, and if this court certainly were to view this conduct as structural, appellant would note that under United States v. Campos, there is a special vigilance that is needed to protect the independence of the Navy Marine Corps and all service member trial judiciary. Trial judges in the military are subject to fitness reports, and they're not given life tenure or even a term of years, much like other courts in our country. They can be moved around, and they're not even guaranteed to remain military judges. They can be placed in a different building. And that's all the more reason why this court should fashion the drastic remedy that was fashioned in Lewis, because of the fact that the UCI here unseated a properly certified and detailed military judge. And Chief Judge Baker, I see my time has expired.
You have some time on rebuttal if there are additional questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain Sam Moore, along with Colonel Stephen Newman. I represent the United States in this case. This case, like most, turns on two things: the error and whether there's prejudice from that error. The error here is limited to the OIC's phone call to the circuit judge.
Okay, are you, as the government, prepared to state then today that you think it's appropriate when you hear a rumor to go through a military judge's personnel file? The government's position?
It is not, Your Honor.
Is the government prepared to state on the record today clearly and succinctly what its position is as to whether the government has access to the personnel files of military judges and under what circumstances?
The government's not prepared to go on the record and explain all of the nuances as to when and how it could be accessed,
asked you to comment on the case before us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was it appropriate for the government to access this personnel record of this judge in this case in the context presented?
Based on the specific context in this case, it was appropriate.
It was, you said?
Yes, Your Honor. Based on the specific context, and that is very important because the government is not trying to present some sort of rule authorization that in every case or in most cases or anything like that.
The government of the United States thinks that it's appropriate to look through a judge's personnel file if they hear a rumor regarding their personal life.
No, Your Honor, it requires more context than that as to what happened in this case, Your Honor.
Please explain what the specific context is which makes this appropriate, please.
In this context, and
you'll have your opportunity to argue whether there is prejudice, UCI prejudice, or not.
Yes, right.
But it seems to me, reading your brief, that you don't think there was anything wrong with this to begin with.
I think based on what we have on the record here, it is not clear that this is a violation of a statute or a rule. But with that said, if it is, and that deserves, frankly, much further discussion and analysis by the rules.
What is the ordinary manner in which one tests a military judge's bias, actual and implied?
Before Jerry, Your Honor.
Okay. Is the ordinary method to go to the personnel file?
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay. But it's the government's view that you're about to tell me that it's nonetheless appropriate in this case, before going to voir dire, to go get that personnel file.
Based on the specific context of this case, and more discussion certainly needs to be had through the Rules Committee and through various as to whether every procedure was followed appropriately, and that's not fully reflected on the record, and honestly, that's where some
What's the context?
Based on the context of this case, the government had a valid basis for voir dire that they identified, which would be the normal way to handle this. And frankly, they did not want to go based on this rumor or innuendo. It's not innuendo, it's poor choice, but rumor. Based on the sensitive nature and a sensitive question involving the military judge and asking this in open court without verifying this information.
Wait a minute. They didn't want to do the sensitive nature, or they didn't want to look dumb if they got the wrong answer.
Well, I mean, I think based on the testimony of the OIC and the military justice officer, they are very aware of the sensitive nature of this question, and they wanted to make sure that they did not want to run into the answer for an
quite example. Apart from the Privacy Act. You know, you keep talking about rule, you know, and you don't know the nuances of the Privacy Act. Doesn't common decency toward a fellow Marine officer who occupies the position of military judge say something to you about the government engaging in this kind of thing?
It does, Your Honor, and that's why the government is certainly not asking this court to bless what happened in this case and say everything that happened is correct.
Well, you seem to be saying that in your brief.
Your Honor, basically.
And you've just stated that it was appropriate.
Based on the specific facts in this case, based on the Privacy Act, for instance.
Do you need to take that position? Do you need to defend what happened in this case in order to make your argument? And if you don't, why would you?
Because I think looking at the error in this case, we need to provide context to it. So even if it is absolutely, the government does not need to take a position that everything that happened here is correct and appropriate. And frankly, it is not. The government takes that position in their brief that everything that happened here is not correct and not appropriate. And we concede apparent UCI. But in this case, whether this is an actual breach of the Privacy Act or something to that degree is for a different form and for a different, which deserves further discussion. Meaning there's nothing on the record that says this is not allowed. But with that said, the government's not asking for this court to bless this. The government's not asking for this court to say this is the way to do it, we want this to happen, or anything along those lines. The government's simply saying what happened with it, simply involving the personnel record, a different form will investigate that is appropriate. But the reason this court does not need to is because, as was asked, that is not dispositive of the question in this case. What's dispositive of the question is what was the specific error and what prejudice, if any, flowed from that error. And that's why the government, again, the government's not asking.
No, not what prejudice flowed from the error, but did the government dissipate the appearance of UCI?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the prejudice.
It's not their burden. It's not their burden to show prejudice. It's your burden to show that everything was fine and okay after the fact.
The government agrees, Your Honor. Beyond the reasonable doubt, the government must prove that the disinterested observer of the public understanding all of the facts and circumstances.
Do all of the facts include the government's position today as to whether this is appropriate conduct?
I think, based on the footnotes of Footnote and Lewis, I don't think that would be an unreasonable position, Your Honor. So again, the government's not asking, frankly, the government doesn't have a government-wide position as to whether this is appropriate and how this should be conducted. Frankly, it is not generally appropriate, should not generally be conducted.
I understand that we're here to decide this particular case, but might that be of some concern to a court such as ours that the government is leaving it to the individual judgment of every OIC, of every legal office out there as to whether they should rifle through personnel files for judges?
No, Your Honor, because
should DOD General Counsel look at our files in case we might need to recuse ourselves from this case because we might have implied bias?
No, Your Honor, the government is not asking this court to leave it to each individual OIC and each individual trial counsel to make that decision on their own. What the government is asking is that with the rules committee that's set up based on the regulation and statute, that those individual entities look into this matter and determine the propriety based on all the facts.
So, counsel, just so that I'm clear, because it seemed initially that your answer to Chief Judge Baker's question was that your position was that it was appropriate. Now it sounds to me like you're saying, you know, that issue is being resolved in a different form. I mean, which is it, that it's being resolved by a different form and you don't take a position, or is it that you have a position?
Position is that based on what we have on the record, it's not clear that this was not allowed, for lack of a better way to say it. We're not asking for any further policy, I mean, judgment on that. But with that said, there are probably more facts that are not in the record that an appropriate body can investigate.
But ultimately, this isn't a civil action involving the Privacy Act. This is a UCI case.
Yes, sir.
And the government concedes at least the appearance of UCI,
yes,
right?
Sir.
They concede, one, the actions. They concede, two, at least the appearance of UCI.
Yes, sir.
On both issues?
The government does not concede the issue with the voir dire.
You do not concede the appearance of UCI with respect to reviewing the personnel file? This is a yes or no question. Does the government concede that point or not?
No, Your Honor. But if this court finds that, still under the analysis and facts in this circumstances, so it's not dispositive. Again, it's not dispositive. So the government does not concede.
I understand that argument.
Well, I don't see how you can parse the two. The rummaging in the file led to the phone call, which you concede,
You can see that the phone call created the appearance of UCI.
Yep.
Based on, if this court finds that both created the appearance of UCI, which is, this court certainly could, but the personnel file situation and the phone call, we have to look at the further context of that.
Okay. What about action?
Is it looking at the personnel file, or is it the voir dire based on the file?
The government's statement would certainly be limited to the looking at the personnel file if that raises a concern with this court. The voir dire of the military judge as a whole, the government certainly, setting aside the personnel file situation, the government certainly does not concede that that raised either apparent or actual UCI. In fact, based on these facts and circumstances, the government submits that it was very relevant and proper, improperly conducted, setting aside the personnel file for a second. And I understand they're twined, but setting aside that, the voir dire was raised neither actual nor apparent UCI.
How does, leaving aside whether you should have done this at all, how does the fact that the judge concededly legally married a young woman in any way indicate bias or the possibility of bias?
That fact alone would not. And that's why, for instance, the government did not ask the military judge at the beginning of this trial, just because it was a child pornography case. They did not come in and voir dire and said, Your Honor, we're aware of this fact, so we want to voir dire you.
But well, because he hadn't done anything. He hadn't made any rulings that made the government mad.
Your Honor, there were rulings.
It was only after you made a bunch of rulings that made the government mad that you did this.
There were certainly rulings that were against the government, and there were certainly rulings that were against the defense in this case. This was litigation. This is certain things the government asked for, the judge said no. Certain things the defense asked for, the judge said no. That is litigation. So it would be not a fair characterization to say the judge was against the
All defense. Right. You have a situation where the government has ruled adversely to the government, the judge has ruled adversely to the government in certain instances.
Yes, sir.
Then and only then do you go follow up this rumor and use this. Now, I repeat the question. What does the fact that the judge lawfully married a young woman have anything to do with actual or apparent bias?
It's not just that he married a young woman. It's that in this case, he married a 17-year-old woman, and that alone would not be a basis for voir dire or any of this. But in this case, there was an issue that revolved around the age of 17, for lack of a better way to say it, whether the military judge was going to define minors 18 or 16.
And did the pictures in this case
you're losing me.
Did the pictures in this case depict teenagers, toddlers, adult people?
Many of them were much younger, Your Honor. As the appellant correctly pointed out, the government expert was going to testify and did not.
They were going to be toddlers. And how many pictures was it necessary for the government to prove in this case, to prove up the charges?
Based on the Clause 2 specifications.
So one picture of a toddler would have been successful?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the government, there's not a factual legal sufficiency issue based on that because there were many pictures well below this age.
Why was this issue then so important to the government, the age issue? Why was it so important to try and remove the judge based on that ruling when, in fact, there were pictures there that could have supported it? That doesn't seem to make any sense. And if it was, in your view, case dispositive, why didn't it go up on an Article 62 appeal?
It was not dispositive, so it would not have withheld.
If it wasn't dispositive, why then was it important enough to remove the military judge?
The government.
And it didn't matter because you admitted that there were pictures there that he could have been convicted on.
Well, it was relevant, Your Honor. Though it was not dispositive, it was relevant. Just as the government could have been successful to age 16 ruling. The government, frankly, could have probably been successful to age 14 ruling as a minor. But the fact that that...
Well, with those pictures, I mean, would you agree that there were pictures there of people younger than 14?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's an example. If the judge came in this case and said, all right, I'm going to make the ruling that the age is...
So ultimately, this would not have made any difference to the government's case as far as success or failure?
I don't think that we can fairly, based on a factual legal sufficiency review, I understand this court's not doing factual sufficiency, but based on that review through the appellate process, it would be successful. But what an individual member might think in the back room as age starts to come down, we can't tell. And so that's why it's relevant.
I have one more case that deals with your law of the case argument.
Yes, sir.
You've taken the position that the issue in this case is restricted to whether or not there should be a dismissal with prejudice, and that's it. And I'm just wondering that if we were to find that the remedy wasn't appropriate at the lower court, I take it to be that your position is that it's all or nothing. We either dismiss with prejudice or we affirm. There, even if we found it, there's no middle ground that we can find, for instance, send it back for a new trial or anything like that.
No, Your Honor, but I think it is in the prejudice analysis saying that the trial judge, replacement judge, and the lower court ruled incorrectly that the remedies were appropriate and that dismissal was appropriate. I think this court could make a intermediate ruling, but it would be limited to that prejudice analysis and based on the UCI, the parent UCI from the call to the circuit judge. So we're not saying it's all or nothing. And the government submits that law of the case is appropriate here, but it's not dispositive.
Counsel, without asking you to concede, can we just pretend that you've conceded just so that you can continue with your argument that the government didn't need to do what it did and that it shouldn't have done what it did?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and move on to why, despite that, it wasn't prejudiced, why, despite that, they were able to dissipate the UCI through the remedial actions.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the only thing I'll say moving on to that point is that looking at both of those, conceding that, you know, for the sake of argument, that those were both improper, we should still look at the context in the sense that they were both with good intentions. That does not mean they're error or not error. That is not relevant to that point. But when we get to the prejudice analysis now, that's relevant to an outside observer looking at these facts and circumstances.
So it wasn't the sort of slanderous rumor mongering that we saw in the Lewis case.
Exactly, Your Honor. So even for the sake of argument, even if going to the personnel file was egregiously wrong based on law, regulation, whatever the
fact. Would you view it as trying to get rid of the judge so they didn't sit on the trial to be a good purpose?
No, Your Honor. I think that there was a unique ruling that came up, and based on the timing, that the way the ruling was done, the fact that it's against the weight of the law, all of these.
What's your good purpose then? If you're wishing for us to look within the totality of the circumstances as we address the ultimate question of whether it was harmless or whatever, you've said we should take into account that it was done for a good purpose. I'm trying to figure out what that good purpose is.
And I was not as careful as I should have been in my words there. I mean, the actions in terms of calling the circuit judge, for instance, by the YSC, though improper, the government concedes that creates the appearance of unlawful command and influence, was done with a good intention. Now, ill-advised, absolutely, the government agrees.
As a military judge, second military judge found.
Yes, Your Honor. So that's the only thing that the government has.
But you're not arguing that the personnel file was done with good intention.
I think even if improper.
Or do you want us to take that into account when we do our harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. You're conceding, for the sake of argument, that's completely improper. That specific trial counsel, every fact on the record supports that we're doing this to confirm so they did not just run into court and say, look what we found, let's shout it out. They wanted to do it correctly. Probably, to avoid the exact rumor mongering that was in Lewis. Now, even if that's completely improper, I think that's relevant to the prejudice analysis.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
The way I was hoping to evaluate this case. Well, first of all, let me say that any motion to recuse a judge made by a participant in a trial is fraught with danger no matter what you do. I mean, you know, you better be right.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Because there you are. The question is, what is the remedy? No matter if you say, I don't want Cox to be my judge because I hate the son of a gun and he cheats at cards and, you know, everything else. But he's not going to grant my motion to recuse, so I got to accuse him of something else. Well, that case is over unless he wins his recusal motion. So the question is, grant the recusal. Now what do we do?
If you grant the recusal,
yeah. Now he's recused. What do we do?
We look at all the facts and circumstances. I mean, saying that this is not
exactly. So I guess Lewis stood for the proposition that could be so egregious that there's no way to cure it.
Yes, sir. And for back.
And the government's position here is, we don't care if it's so egregious or not, Your Honor, because it was done. He recused himself. Now, how did it affect the subsequent trial?
That would not be the government's argument, Your Honor. So in a sense, the defense is asking, in one way or another, however they word it, they're saying that this is structural, for lack of a better way, because the recusal was so egregious. The government's position is not, you can go seek the military judge's for dear.
But what would we have done if the judge said, yeah, I married a 17-year-old, so what? I'm not recusing myself. Next question.
Absolutely, and that's absolutely what could have happened here, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That was the military judge's decision, his discretion. When they came up and they said, Your Honor, we're going to ask you this question, we're going to move the recusal, the military judge could have said, Nope, the basis is not valid. I don't think an observer would be concerned, and they could have moved on. Now, whether further action down the road took place, as in Lewis, where they came back, that's a different story. We don't have that in front of us. But based on what we have in front of us is he did recuse himself, a replacement military judge did move in, and we had a full and open litigation of the issues on the record. Now, that's one factor, and that's important, as in Campos, because that's, again, this is not, nobody in this process is given a stamp of approval, and so I know it's going back and forth in the Privacy Act, probably unnecessarily with you, Chief Judge Baker, but we're not asking for this court or any other court to give a stamp of approval on this action. We're saying further investigation, further...
How were these actions remediated, and were they effective? Was the remediation effective?
The remediation was, it was effective, and here there are a couple of ways it was remediated. First, he upheld the defense-friendly rulings, replacement military judge did.
Well, what about the spousal privilege? I mean, he did reverse that particular ruling.
Well, a little more nuanced than that, at least from the government's perspective, Your Honor, and that is correct that what the appellant brought up. First, they brought it up for the first time in the reply brief. They did not object to the trial, so we'd say in a sense it's waived because the replacement
Let's figure out what happened there. The first judge ruled that there was a confidential communication, and the second judge ruled that there wasn't a confidential communication.
But the dispositive issue as to whether the wife was going to be able to testify on this was not decided, and that's what's important. So we agree with the appellant that the first military judge says confidential communication. The second military judge ended up ruling on that basis. But the first military judge said confidential communication, but
Was he removed from participation in the trial?
Was who removed
from who was it? The military justice officer, whoever he was. He was banned from the courtroom because he was a witness, which is regular procedure in most cases. But then the CCA found that he was removed from further participation in the trial, and I didn't see that in the record.
We agree, Your Honor. We agree with the appellant's position on that, that this was the OIC was banned from the courtroom, which is a symbolic gesture here. He was not the SJA, so he does not have a command relationship. He's not advising the committee authority. He's not in that
position. But he's supervising the trial counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
So just give me the list of the remediation steps that were taken. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
He upheld the defense-friendly rulings. He upheld minor as 16, that definition. He prevented the otherwise lawful reconsideration by a military judge. So, for instance, throughout the trial, they could not come back and recon. He barred the OIC from returning to the courtroom. And based on the specific error here, the specific allegation that was raised at trial, no further remedy was needed based on this error.
And what was the reason that he barred the individual from the courtroom?
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
Yep, answer. Please.
Because he was a witness in this proceeding.
Okay. And that was not specifically in response to finding a mediation, or at least I didn't see that.
I believe the replacement military, at the time he said that on the record at J189, he did not say that, but when he made his written findings of facts and his conclusion of law, I believe he did tie that to the UCI. So again, that's a symbolic gesture. It's not dispositive alone, but when you tie all those factors again, into, again, with the intentions, though ill-advised, improper actions taken in this case, good intentions with these remedial actions, a member of the public being aware of all of this and not just slices of this would understand that fully informed of all these factors and circumstances, they would not harbor significant doubt about the fairness of these proceedings. If there are no further questions.
I have one question. How do we deal with, I guess that's Lewis, the question of, if a fair trial remedies UCI, does not that invite this activity in the future? Since the remedy then just says, oh, well, we got caught, so let's do a fair trial now.
No, Your Honor, because each case turns on its own unique facts and circumstances. Lewis, based on the egregious actions in that case, based on what took place on the record, the perception, even at the accused mother testifying on the stand, based on all those facts and circumstances, the court found that perception-wise for the public could not be remedied. But in a circumstance like this, though you could have individual actions that were ill-advised, improper, however you want to word it, based on the totality of the circumstances, you have to look at it and say, did the government gain something? Did they improperly gain something? Was this with bad intentions? Were they gunning for the judge and said, we just have to get this judge out of here? If those facts are in the record, that'd be different. But they're not. And based on the facts and circumstances in this case, with the remedial measures based on the specific...
The appellant has argued that they should have, as remedy, dismissed or do whatever you do with the trial counsel. And that action was not taken. What's the government's argument there?
I don't believe that was even asked.
Other than it didn't need to happen, but I mean, why not?
I think that was asked for a trial. I think what's the other fact that I didn't mention based on time, was you look at what happened at trial, what the defense counsel was asking for. They were certainly asking for dismissal, and they were trying to point to prejudice. But short of that, they tell the replacement military judge, in regards to the fairness and impartiality of the military judge, the defense doesn't have any concerns about whether it's you or the original military judge. Now, we agree that's not them saying everything was great in this case, but they're not coming in saying, we need you to do this, we're requesting this to happen, we're requesting this to happen. They said dismissal or nothing. And
so just to be clear, that there was no particular remedy requested by the defense counsel other than a dismissal? Meaning, they did, for example, did they ask that the trial counsel be removed and the military judge said no?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't want to misspeak on that, but I don't believe so. I don't believe there's any other specific
remedy. I'm sure appellate counsel
will. Yeah. We'll hear both sides on that one, no doubt. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Check the record on that one, then, is what you're saying to us.
No, I don't want to put a burden on the court on that. No, just, okay. I cannot, based on my memory.
No, fair enough. That's a nice way of handling it. Are there any other questions up here? Thank you, trial government counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, please.
Could you start by answering the question that I asked the government, which is, was there a particular remedial measure that the defense counsel at trial requested that the military judge did not implement?
Well, Your Honor, the government's correct that the defense asked for dismissal with prejudice, and that was based on United States v. Lewis. That remedy would have been appropriate here because of the government's conduct in this case. But Judge Morey specifically, Your Honor, on joint appendix,
just to be clear, your position then, I think at the beginning you sort of said it wasn't your position, but it sounds to me like the defense position from the beginning has been that this couldn't be remedied and that dismissal was the only permissible response to what happened.
That is our position, Your Honor, under United States v. Lewis. The appellant raises the issue of whether or not these remedies were sufficient, though, because this court did look at that aspect in Lewis, and it found that specifically the remedies were insufficient. Nothing could cure that. So here, this court is confronted with arguably even worse facts, and it would not be
in Lewis?
That in Lewis, yes, Your Honor. And we believe so because of the adverse rulings that were made, contrary to the government, that then triggered the phone call, the service record, et cetera. The government stated to a question from Judge Cox that the military judge here could have very well just recused himself, but that couldn't have happened here because Judge Morey actually found that the government's actions invaded his deliberative process. And Judge Richardson at Joint Appendix 214 also found just that the government's actions here essentially put the military judge in a position where he had to recuse himself. And further, dismissal with prejudice is the only appropriate remedy because just as in Lewis, if this court were to send this case back to a trial before any other military judge besides Colonel Morey, then the government would get exactly what it wanted in the first place.
But what I'm trying to understand is why would a reasonable member of the public think that the government gained something from it, right? I mean, that somehow the trial was unfair, that the trial was unfair, not that the government got what it wanted, not that they shouldn't have done what they did, but that they would have serious doubts as to the fairness and integrity of the trial.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's for the fact that the OIC of the Law Center, who's the supervisor of the trial counsel, called the supervisor of the military judge.
That's what they did wrong. Right?
Sure, Your
that's
Honor.
What they did wrong.
Regarding prejudice, then, and
I mean,
and
what,
I see my
what,
time's
what about the second judge? What about the second judge, right, was helpful to the government or harmful to the defense?
Well, Your Honor, regarding the second judge's remedial measure of upholding defense-friendly rulings, the record reveals that was not fully implemented. Under the United States
but even under that, what I'm asking you is what about the trial that ultimately happened with a member of the public, because that's one of the facts that they know, right, is everything that happened, and we'll presume that they know all the law and who got what right with respect to what ruling. You know, why would they think that it wasn't all fair?
Well, Your Honor, perhaps...
That's what I'm asking you, because if your answer is it doesn't matter, it's just it happened, therefore it needed to be dismissed with prejudice, what you're really arguing is that it was structural error.
Well, Your Honor, it is the government's burden to show whether or not prejudice was removed here. But appellants certainly, if this court were to look at this from a structural error standpoint, then appellant certainly would not contest to that analysis. based on the government's actions in this case, which were essentially usurping the Judge Advocate General of the Navy's authority to properly certify in detail a military judge, the government would question the fairness of this proceeding. The government would look at this tribunal as the very tribunal that the UCMJ was designed to prevent when it was first implemented in the 1950s, and that's removing UCI from the court's martial systems. And for all these reasons, Your Honor, appellant respectfully requests that this court dismiss his case with prejudice.
Any other questions? All right, thank you. The court thanks both counsel. And we stand recess until tomorrow. Thank you very much.
All rise.